Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and start the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Today we have two public hearings with possible work sessions and then some work sessions that are carried over. What we're going to do is start with SJR 28. Two of our members who are sponsors of the bill, Senator Hass and Representative Reed, are here. Why don't y'all come on up and get us started? And before you get started, just for the information for the audience, Senator Cruz is involved in a work group, and I believe Senator Wissett will be here shortly.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski, and hello to the members of the Judiciary Committee. My name is Mark Hass. Thank you for considering SJR 28. I think you know that this is a proposed ballot measure that will go out to voters with an idea of making a very minor modification into Oregon's speech provision that will help regulate adult businesses, to use that term very charitably in what we're talking about here. This is an issue that came up in my community and was raised by a very large segment of that community about a year ago. And we believe that this is a narrow and carefully considered approach to permit reasonable zoning regulations in adult businesses in Oregon communities. I just want to put it in perspective, and I have some testimony, some written testimony that I'll submit. We were having some printer issues in our office today. But to put this into perspective, I think you have all seen in your own districts this dynamic play out where neighbors protest and adult business near there. In this particular community, on a major thoroughfare between Portland and Beaverton, neighbors packed a Presbyterian church, about 250 people, every week for about 3 months, trying to figure out what to do. They could not really get any kind of a solution from the city or from the county, and they went to their state representatives. These are, when I say adult businesses, that is charitable, because many of them, some of them are lingerie rooms, modeling shops, and they're a step beyond or a step below your standard run-of-the-mill adult bookstore. That is what we're talking here. And this summer, in front of those establishments, some of the employees, some of the dancers would get out in wading pools, in bikinis, and wave at traffic, waving in potential customers. And I think some of our constituents rightly asked the question, what are we supposed to tell our kids about what those people are doing? How do we explain what this is about? And so we bring this ballot measure before you. We know all too well that Oregonians have engaged in this dialogue before. Back in the 90s, there were two ballot measures to do this. But I would submit that things are different today than they were in the 90s. For one thing, Oregon has distinguished itself as one of the top states on a per capita basis of adult businesses. And that is not a distinction that I don't think anybody cares to advance. It is certainly not one that I'm proud of. And also, a dynamic that didn't exist in the 1990s is sex trafficking. And I know you have some sex trafficking bills before you, and therefore you know that that is a very complicated issue. But I think you would have to agree that the proliferation of adult businesses in Oregon, that does not make sex trafficking an easier issue to deal with. It makes it more difficult. So we're offering this. I think it's not unreasonable to ask Oregonians to allow cities to regulate these kind of businesses. You know, Oregon prides itself on having some of the most strict land use laws in the country. Land use laws that tell people where they can build a house and where they can't build a house. Land use laws that tell people what their neighborhood should look like. So I just don't think it's unreasonable for those neighbors to say, this is not something that we want in our neighborhoods. I'll turn this over to my good colleague, Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Good morning. I'm Tobias Reed, State Representative from District 27. Happy to be here with Senator Hass and some of our constituents. And Senator Hass has done a good job explaining a lot of what brings us here, so I won't be long. But just to add a couple of comments, Senator Haas mentioned the experiences we've had with some of our constituents in town halls. This is, I think, our effort to help those constituents convene a conversation here. I think all of us take very seriously the free speech provisions. It's the foundation of our system of government. But as Senator Haas mentioned, the land use question is a good one. I'm on the Transportation Economic Development Committee in the House, and like several other committees, we've become something of a land use committee. And so I've been learning more about how land use works in Oregon, and more about how different parts of the state, different kinds of land are classified, what activities are and are not allowed. And I think this is a reasonable question to ask as it relates to this this issue. A couple of things have changed since our last session. For me, one of the biggest is a year and a half ago when we brought our daughter home from the hospital. And that being a parent causes me to look at things a bit differently. Seeing those businesses that Senator Haas described in our community makes me think about our daughter and about other women in Oregon, and that's a large part of why I'm here. We have some constituents here and some others who will have some things to say about their experiences, but I appreciate your willingness to hear the bill and to continue the conversation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. Question, Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for your testimony, Senator Haas and Representative Reed. I attended the meeting that Senator Haas and Representative Reed talked about, and they are correct that there were a lot of people who were very concerned. Many of the places that Senator Haas mentioned are in the district I represent. I drive by them on a daily basis. I know there's someone here who can clarify this. I believe the issue has been referred 3 times to the voters. And with response to Representative Reed's question about being a parent and how that changes things, I remember one time driving by a place with my daughter, because there's several of these places very close to where I live, and her question was, what happens on take your child to work day? And frankly, I didn't know how to answer that. So thank you, Senator Haas and Representative Reed. I look forward to having this conversation and seeing what the testimony is. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Oh, but I do have a question. May I, Mr. Chair? I'm sorry. Senator Haas and Representative Reed, we have received several emails from people who are nudists, and they are concerned that this will impair their ability to enjoy their hot tub in the nude. Is that your intent?
That's certainly not our intent. It's way off, and I think it's one of those red herrings that confuses the discussion.
I think I just want to make sure that's on the record.
Agreed.
All right. First, let's see if there's any other questions or comments from the members. Bill?
Chairman of the Committee, Representative Reed, Senator Haas, what do you mean by the term live entertainment? I assume you're not talking about a singer or a dance band or anything like that.
Are you referring to what's in the...
it'd be on line 9. May offer live entertainment. This section does not prohibit the state or the county municipalities from regulating the location of a business that may offer live entertainment.
Mr. Chair, Councilor Taylor, I would say this, I think our intent is much about the location of land use sort of question. So just as we decide what kind of industrial activity is appropriate in certain places, what other kinds of use are appropriate in other places, I think the language that's added in the second paragraph, or line 8 through line 11, is intending to allow local jurisdictions to make those decisions.
So what you're talking about would be referred to as adult entertainment, as opposed to the normal live entertainment of a band or something like that?
Councillor Taylor, that is exactly it. It is adult entertainment.
All right. Any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have a number of people who have signed up who want to give testimony. What I'm going to do is call up panels of individuals. We're going to rotate between proponents and opponents. The first group that we'll have, I believe it's Hal Scoggins and Rob Drake.
Good Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Hal Scoggins, and I am an attorney in Portland, but I'm not here representing any client. I'm here as a citizen of one of the neighborhoods that Senator Haas spoke about near where Senator Bonamici lives that has been affected by these businesses. I live on Canyon Drive, which is just off the Canyon Road area that that they've been speaking about. And I'm here to thank you for considering this bill and to ask you to pass it on to the floor for passage and for referral to the voters of Oregon. This bill is not about what happens inside these places. This bill is about what happens around these places. The reason that neighbors, at least in our neighborhood, became so concerned last summer was not that they really had a particular interest in new dancing or other activities that were carried on in these businesses, but it's that they felt the ill effects from these businesses in their homes, as they were going to school, as they were visiting nearby businesses. We had a very popular business that was located next to one of these places. It was a martial arts center that catered primarily to children. That martial arts center simply had to move. It couldn't continue to operate once these businesses opened up next door because of the harassment that parents felt they received from both patrons and employees of these places and of the things that their children were exposed to. Senator Bonamici talked about the question from a child going by. Another question from a child going by today, looking at one of those signs, might be, "Mommy, what's a full friction lap dance?" And I think those are the kinds of effects that that people started to become concerned about. And then they saw drunkenness that spilled over into people's yards and homes, trash, people that were coming to these places drunk or drinking or bringing alcohol to the places and consuming them there, even if the lap dance places didn't serve alcohol themselves, and so they're not regulated by OLCC. And it's not always easy for the local officials to deal with these problems in terms of code enforcement, employment laws, liquor laws, or other violations, simply because they are private establishments. And if they don't have a liquor license and aren't subject to inspection by the OLCC, then issues are dealt with on a citizen complaint basis. And when citizens don't go inside, it becomes difficult for them to make any kind of credible complaint about what's going on inside. The issue really, again, is what goes on outside. And the difficulty that local officials have in dealing with these effects on the neighbors and on the businesses that surround them. Senator Bonamici made reference to three bills that have been put before the voters in the past 15 years or so. This bill is different than each of those other bills. One might ask why would be worthwhile to submit yet another bill to the voters on this issue. The reason is that this bill is much more moderate in its scope of what it tries to do. First of all, it doesn't attempt to regulate movies, written materials, anything other than dancing or other nude entertainment that's performed by live people. And when Mr. Taylor asked about what that phrase, live entertainment, meant, I think if you look at the bill, it's further described by the language that follows it, performed by a person who is nude. So what we're talking about is not video, it's not written material, it's not anything but entertainment or some other types of services that are performed by living, breathing human beings that that happen to be nude. The other question that was addressed is, you know, what would happen? Could somebody be zoned or otherwise restricted in their ability to enjoy their hot tub in their home in the nude? And this bill is not aimed at that. This bill wouldn't permit that. This bill permits zoning of businesses that are offering entertainment or other services performed by people in the nude. It doesn't get to what people do in the privacy of their own homes, even if it's in their front yards or their backyards, in the view of other people. This bill would not regulate by itself anything, and it wouldn't permit regulation other than zoning. All it would do is say, we recognize that there can be ill effects that are created by these businesses. We recognize that they can have a negative impact on residential communities and the businesses that locate near those communities to serve those communities. So we'll give cities and towns the choice. We'll give cities and towns the ability to say, are there negative impacts here in our area? And if so, what kind of zoning should we do to deal with them? Each city, each county, each town would have the capability of making its own decision about what to do about these businesses. And it can make that decision based on input from the local citizens. That's what this bill is about. It's about giving localities the choice, giving localities the ability to implement some sort of fair balance between the rights of these businesses to carry on their legitimate business versus the rights of citizens in surrounding areas to enjoy their homes and their businesses free from the interference that often comes from these businesses. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify this morning.
All right, thank you. Rob?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm here as a private citizen. I did serve as the full-time mayor of Beaverton from 1993 through 2008. Beaverton now has two adult
I need you to put your full name on the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. Rob Drake.
Thank you.
Beaverton now has two adult video stores, two new dancing bars, and a lingerie shop within the city of Beaverton. Four of the five facilities are in prime retail locations and visible to everyone. I witnessed these facilities opening business in Beaverton, and frankly, there was nothing we could do about it. I fully understand Oregon and its law and court decisions regarding adult businesses and protections under the First Amendment provisions of the Oregon Constitution. The change allowing these businesses began with a court decision in the early 1980s involving the city of Portland. As a result, Oregon now has one of the highest per capita numbers of adult businesses in the country. Our rate of unemployment continues to be one of the worst in the nation. How can we attract new business to the state with this notorious reputation? Currently, we regulate zoning, designating where people can live and our retail businesses in industry can locate. Why can't we do it with the adult business industry? Local government currently doesn't allow a batch plant or a slaughterhouse to be located in a residential neighborhood, so we should be able to say where specific businesses can be located. We wouldn't be keeping adult businesses from exercising their First Amendment rights and conducting their business, but we could designate that they could be allowed in only specific use zones like we do with other businesses. Please give Oregon voters an opportunity to vote on this important issue.
Questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our next panel is going to be Andrea Meyer and Greg Chamoff. And for those who are giving testimony today, if you do have written testimony, we request that you not read your testimony, but summarize it, and because we will be reading through your written testimony independently.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon, here today in opposition to SJR 28. Article 1, Section 8, the provision that would be amended by this bill was passed by the people in 1857 and effective upon statehood in 1859, and it provides, no law shall be passed restraining the free expression of opinion or restricting the right to speak, write, or print freely on any subject whatever, but every person shall be responsible for the abuse of this right. SJR 28 adds an exception to this provision by granting authority to government to regulate businesses based on the content of their expression of what goes on inside. In the past 17 years, there's actually been four votes related to amending Article 1, Section 8, and three of those in the last 17 years have had the same purported intent as the proponents today, and each time they have been rejected by the Oregonians, who have made it clear they don't want the government telling them what they can read, see, and hear. Briefly, in 1994, the Oregon legislature referred Measure 19 to the voters to amend Article 1, Section 8, and it added a new provision to Article 1, Section 8. It said it shall not be interpreted to prevent the people, the legislative assembly, or any city or county from enacting laws regulating or prohibiting obscenity to the extent permitted by the United States Constitution. For purposes of this section, the term obscenity shall have the meaning given to it by the United States Supreme Court, and in addition shall also include child pornography. Despite the invocation of obscenity and child pornography, which I want to note is not protected speech in Oregon, voters rejected Measure 19 by 55% to 45%. 2 years later, in 1996, Measure 31 was referred to the voters, again invoking obscenity and child pornography and stating that it shall receive no greater protection under this Constitution than afforded under the U.S. Constitution. Again, rejected by voters 52% to 47%. I note in 26 of the 36 counties, it was across the state. 4 years later, now in 2000, Measure, so this is three times in 6 years, the legislature referred Measure 87 to add two new provisions to the Oregon Constitution, Article 1, Section 8. And I want to note the language because it is, as I read it, very similar to what the proponents are seeking to do here. Slightly different language, same goal. Notwithstanding Section 8 of this article, to the extent permitted by the United States Constitution, political subdivisions in this state may, through the use of zoning authority, regulate the location of sexually oriented businesses. And then it proceeded to define those businesses related to nude dancing and nude entertainment and so on. That, again, was rejected by voters by 52% to 47%, and again, across the state, no rural or urban divide in this question. Now, there is one more recent attempt to amend the free expression provision worth noting, and that was in 2006, when Oregonians, I think, made it clear that they don't want to weaken our free expression provision no matter what the reason. Measure 46 amended Article 1, Section 8 to allow for the purposes of prohibiting or limiting campaign contributions and expenditures. Although in that case the proponents purposely attempted to hide the fact that this was an amendment to Article 1, Section 8, voters understood the effect, when they rejected this proposal in every county by a 60% to 40% vote. Measure 46 is informative to the discussion here today, because at the same time that voters rejected weakening the free expression provision to authorize the limitation of campaign contribution and expenditures, they also passed the companion statutory proposal, Measure 47. What explains the difference? Oregonians have concerns about election process, but they also understood and rejected solving campaign finance by amending our Bill of Rights, specifically Article 1, Section 8. And it was the argument that this amendment amended our free expression provision that was pivotal. All but one argument in opposition to Measure 46 urged voters to reject it because it would weaken our free expression provision. Those included statements from Planned Parenthood to Right to Life, to name a few. Now, here are the arguments proponents used with Measure 19, Measure 31, and Measure 87, identical to the arguments you've heard and will probably likely hear in support of SJR 28. These proposals will simply give local jurisdictions the authority to regulate, not ban adult businesses. These constitutional amendments would protect women, children, and make our neighborhoods safe. And these measures simply bring us into alignment with other states consistent with the protections of the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. And those urging passage of Measure 19, 31, and 87 included district attorneys, religious organizations, neighborhood associations, mayors, business groups, and legislators. It's fair to say that voters clearly understood the arguments made by proponents at that time, and it's also fair to say that voters clearly rejected these arguments as recently as 5 years ago. With all due respect to the proponents of SJR 28, this issue has been asked and answered, and asked and answered over again. In other hearings, it's been noted by the legislature should be at least reluctant to revisit decisions made by voters. As best we know, there is no other constitutional referral sent to voters 3 times in 6 years. As one voter pamphlet stated in Measure 87 in 2000 and asked, what part of no does the legislature not understand? And yet, only 11 years later, an almost identical proposal, and just 5 years after the last attempt to weaken Article 1, Section 8, this legislature is being asked to pass SJR 28 to the voters. This surely ignores the clearly expressed wishes of Oregonians. They've made it clear they don't want to amend our free expression provision. They don't want to, the government to tell them what they can read, see, and hear. And we respectfully urge you not to proceed with this measure. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, Greg Chamov, pleasure to be back in front of you again. I wear a number of hats, including the president of a city council that would be empowered were this measure to pass. I'm not wearing that hat today, although it informs my views on this kind of regulation. I'm appearing today as a cooperating attorney for the ACLU. Article 1, Section 8 is one of the finest parts of any constitution in the world. Please leave it alone. Except in rare circumstances, such as yelling fire in a theater, the government is not allowed to assume that saying, reading, or watching something is harmful. More than any other place, the people of Oregon wanted to be left alone in their homes and businesses and not be told what they could say, read, or watch. Let me focus on what Mr. Scoggins told you. He says that this is a bill or measure that focuses not on the interior, but on the exterior of a business. If you look at the text of the measure, it focuses entirely on the inside of a business. It would outlaw activity by an organization or a business and does not address at all the activity that goes on outside the business. After Oregon's courts determined that naked wasn't dangerous and governments couldn't regulate businesses and organizations based on whether people were naked inside, the Attorney General came up with a model form of ordinance for local governments to adopt to protect themselves from the activities of businesses that bothered neighbors and bothered neighboring businesses. Most local governments in the state, including the one on which I serve, have code provisions that permit the local government to shut down a business if the business is annoying the neighbors. If any one of three events, sometimes it's a law violation, sometimes it's a local ordinance violation, occur within the span of a month, whether it's harassing the neighbors, being drunk and disorderly outside, fighting, soliciting prostitution, selling drugs, taking your clothes off outside, or even peeing outside, we can shut the business down. And we can do that whether it's a strip club, a lingerie modeling club, a Rotary club, or a Bible club. Whatever goes on inside that building is just fine so long as they don't annoy the neighbors. So long as a business and its patrons behave themselves, a city shouldn't have a problem. The legislative assembly shouldn't have a problem. And no local government should have a problem with people watching beach volleyball in skimpy outfits on TV or naked people in the flesh. Please keep Article 1, Section 8 the way it is. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. And Andrea, you mentioned a couple times in your testimony that people don't want the government to decide what they can read, see, and hear. Mm-hmm. But it's my understanding that the intent of this isn't to decide what people can read, see, and hear, but rather where they can read, see, and hear it. Can you talk about the distinction?
Chair Przanski, Senator Bonamici, not sure what you mean by the distinction. It's what they can read, see, or hear, whether it's in their homes or going to businesses that provide entertainment, be it the production of hair that includes nudity or any other kind of business and what goes on. And in terms of the decision that Oregonians have made on those three ballot measures, that's what we walked away from with the conclusion that they were rejecting the idea of limiting where and what they can read, see, and hear. I mean, these businesses are, to be clear, not in residential zoned areas. So there are limitations, and it's important to remind ourselves that we're talking about regulating businesses in areas that are otherwise zoned for businesses based on the content of the speech that goes on inside, or in this case, the expressive speech and activity that goes on inside. That's legal. I'm not sure I've clarified your question, but thank you.
All right. Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much
for
coming forward. Our next panel will be, I believe it's Jack Warman and Becky Montague. Give us your name, please, and then your testimony.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Becky Montague, and I am currently the Director of Development for City Christian Schools. City Christian Schools has been in existence in the Portland area for 37 years, and we serve 360 students combined in preschool through 12th grade. I strongly support Senate Joint Resolution 28. I support SJR 28 because the children in our school are directly impacted by having a number of sexually explicit shops offering nude entertainment and services located near the intersection of Northeast 82nd Avenue and Northeast Fremont in Portland, which is the main route of many of our families have to take when bringing their children to school. In my opinion, having unsavory establishments like these in a location surrounded by neighborhoods, schools, and local eateries where children are often present is very bad for children and families in our community. Other parents that I've talked to have commented to me that these types of businesses flaunt entertainment and services they provide on signage that draws children's attention, like pussycats and jello wrestling. In addition to being in charge of recruitment, I also am a parent, and I find the advertised sexually explicit services on the signage of these businesses to be offensive in an environment where minors are present, with terms such as rub down, shower shows, stripper poles, hot naked girls, lingerie shows, and massages. One such business is directly next to the local McDonald's where kids are present throughout the week. High school kids from Madison High School and City Christian High School frequent this McDonald's daily and are subjected to the explicit advertising, the children-friendly language of the marketing, and the women right in front of them. What type of message does it send when we can't protect our kids? It's a shame that adult businesses like these can be opened within a few blocks of a long-standing private school, Madison High School, and also Jason Lee Elementary, Gregory Heights Middle School, are in close proximity. The schools and the children were there first and should be protected. There's been a large increase of unsavory people that are attracted to this area because of the multiple explicit shops with live nude entertainment and services. Teachers and board members have been propositioned by prostitutes when going to lunch at these local Mexican and Chinese restaurants. The prostitutes have brazenly walked up and knocked on their car window when they pulled into the parking lot to eat lunch. When prostitution increases, you know that pimps and drug dealers are not far behind. It's a major issue here in Portland, and it is spreading across the state. Communities need to be protected. When is it going to stop? Child trafficking for sexual exploitation is a huge problem currently in Oregon, and we're allowing the sex industry to set up shop next to our schools and neighborhoods. How does that make sense when we have such a large problem with sexual exploitation of children through trafficking? We should be limiting children being introduced to sexually explicit entertainment and services in our neighborhoods. This is a reasonable resolution. Please let the people of Oregon decide this issue, and please vote to support SJR 28. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today.
Chairman Brzezinski and members of the committee, my name is Jack Lohman, and I'm currently the co-executive director of Oregon Family Council. Oregon Family Council was founded over 30 years ago and represents approximately 30,000 members and a network of over 2,000 churches across the state of Oregon. The Oregon Family Council believes that sexually explicit businesses are dangerous and destructive to individuals and society in general. We further believe that communities should have the ability to protect schools, parks, community centers, churches, and residential neighborhoods from the impact of explicit adult or porn-related businesses. That is why our organization and its members strongly support Senate Joint Resolution 28 and ask for this committee to give Oregonians the chance to vote on this issue. Without proper oversight, through regulation and zoning, the proliferation of sexually explicit establishments across our state has grown exponentially. The current system is broken and needs to be fixed to protect our children
neighborhoods, and schools. The entire state of Oregon is affected by this, and many local communities have no recourse to protect these child-sensitive areas. This is especially concerning with the growing problem of sex trafficking in the state of Oregon. Why would we allow the intermingling of the sex industry and child-sensitive areas such as schools, neighborhood parks, community centers to be in close proximity? Senate Joint Resolution 28 is reasonable in its scope and intent. Senate SJR 28 does not suppress free speech, but rather, like many situations in our society, allows reasonable regulation and zoning to protect the common good of communities and protect children. This resolution does not suppress speech, but gives local officials a say where this type of speech may be located, which is a reasonable opinion according to Justice John Paul Stevens in his majority opinion in Young v. American Mini Theaters, Inc. Throughout the United States, many local communities have the ability to protect sensitive community areas from being overrun by these types of sexually explicit establishments. Case history shows that establishing distance buffers to sensitive community areas through zoning is acceptable to the courts and the law. A few examples of these are included in my written testimony that I submitted. Senate Joint Resolution 28 and the reference examples do not limit free speech, but rather deal with the time, place, and manner of these activities, which is deemed acceptable by the courts. Allowing sexually explicit establishments to have a free run of our state is incredibly harmful to local businesses, communities, and children. The secondary effects from the increased concentration of these explicit establishments are real. Allowing the sex industry to locate near child-sensitive areas, such as neighborhoods, schools, and churches, is a very dangerous precedent to continue to allow. Oregon Family Council supports Senate Joint Resolution 28 to give the people of Oregon an opportunity to vote on this issue and address the very real threat to communities and children in Oregon. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you very much, Jack, for summarizing your testimony. Any questions or comments? Thank you all very much for coming forward today. Our last panel that's of individuals that have signed up is Shirley, and last name I can't read. I think it's Guthrie. Michael, I believe it's Parker, and John Kinman.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is John Kinman. I live in Springfield, Oregon. I'm the past president of the American Association for Nude Recreation, and I'm also the past president of the Willamettans, which is a nudist park located near Marcola, Oregon. Anna is very concerned about the potential unintended consequences of this constitutional amendment. I'm not an attorney, but I have concerns about the wording in here. I sympathize and understand the intent of the legislation as it's been portrayed to us. But as I read the words, I come up with a different story and see this being interpreted differently by communities all over the state. The word sexually explicit business doesn't show up in this legislation. Mere nudity is what is in here that can be regulated against. Last Saturday night, we sang karaoke in the lodge. I guess some people were performing. We're a club. We're a business enterprise. And, of course, some people were nude. I guess we would be in violation of this if our local community decided we would. It's been said that we're not the targets of this bill. It's aimed at the adult entertainment industry. My legal advisors tell me, however, that with this wording in the state constitution, any government agency in this state could, at some point in the future, use these very words to outlaw our legitimate activities, which are now sanctioned by several state agencies and protected by our constitution. I respectfully ask that you vote against this bill. Thank you.
Good morning, Senators. My name is Michael Parker. I'm a resident of the state of Oregon as well as a member of ANR also. I rise to speak against Senate Joint Resolution 28, which, as written, would potentially lead to criminalizing unoffensive simple nudity as well as the practice of organized nudism in the state of Oregon. For many years, ANNR has fought to decriminalize family-oriented nudism and has been successful in many areas. This bill, I believe, is a major step backwards. While I understand the intent is to be able to regulate adult-oriented businesses, this bill does far more than that. There are ANNR clubs in the state of Oregon that are 78 years old, as well as many newer ones. All of them could be regulated out of business under this proposed constitutional change. All ANNR clubs in the state are cooperatively owned by the members, and many of the services members of the clubs perform, from pool cleaning to lawn mowing to weeding and more, are done in the nude when weather is appropriate. Some of our members even sing karaoke while nude, as John mentioned. These could be considered services and entertainment under this bill, and under this bill, they could be regulated away. I doubt this is the target SCR 28 is probably aiming at. There are numerous ANNR members and non-members in Oregon that skinny dip at the two legal nude beaches in the state or use remote public hot springs. This bill could change all of that. Again, is this necessary regulation or a case of unintended consequences? I prefer, instead of this bad bill, the strong protection given by the present section of one of Article 1 in the State Bill of Rights. I also believe in leaving Oregon's free expression clause in the Constitution just as it currently is. Please do not advance this flawed bill to be voted on by the people of Oregon. Thank you for your time and consideration of this issue.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair and committee members. My name is Shirley Gauthier. I live in Springfield, Oregon, and I'm also a member of the Willamette Family Nudist Resort. We're a member, a three-year member of the Chamber of Commerce and a member of the Travel Lane County Visitor Bureau. I'm no stranger, being on the Chamber of Commerce, to the struggles and frustrations that the sex industry, strip joints, strip clubs bring to our community. I'm also no stranger to the misconceptions that they bring to myself as a nudist. ANNR spends an incredibly large amount of money fighting legislation on state levels. Our resort has over 100 full-service licensed RV sites, cabins, houses, rentals, pools, tennis courts, so it's much more than my hot tub going nude in my backyard. We also work with the Multnomah County Sheriff's Department, the Oregon State Police Department, the Oregon State Parks Department at Rooster Rock and Sauvy Island. We spend an incredible amount of time contributing back to our communities. I remember in high school an instructor saying to me that we students should be really proud that we live in a state whose constitution protects the personal freedoms and rights of everyone. As I listen to the testimony today, and it seems like it says it's just a zoning issue, simply put, it seems to say that we just want to relocate these businesses. What part of our communities are going to open their doors? Relocating and chipping away at our constitution to relocate a business in another zone, it's not the answer. Our state constitution is something we Oregonians can be proud of because we protect everybody's right. We can't pick and choose. We have local laws and ordinances that we can use to fight these and struggle with the frustrations that these businesses bring. Please don't chip away at our Constitution for an answer that will bring unintended consequences for theater, arts, museums, and, yes, nudist parks. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions or comments? Thank you very much for coming forward. Yes.
Council, a question about whether there are other. Is that already asked the question? Are there other? Are there bills that are in the system now that address things like the wage issues or labor issues or tax issues or other issues that are sometimes associated with adult entertainment facilities?
Mr. Chairman, Committee Senator Bonamici, there are several bills in the legislature. One that would say that if you are a entertainer and required to return part of your tips to the house, you'd be considered an employee of the house. Another one that would regulate places that rent out space for under 24 hours, and the amendment would say for cash, because that seems to be a way that the lingerie places and other adult entertainment places make money. in the sense that they rent out space to lingerie models for short periods of time, and it's all done in cash, so there's no record of it as it relates to tax purposes. There are two proposals in the House Judiciary Committee, one that would adopt the language of the federal constitution and replace Article 1, Section 8, and another one that would allow regulation as it relates to giving hardcore pornography to kids.
Thank you.
As you know, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's sometimes difficult in this area to define what is hardcore and what is not.
All right.
Could I ask you, Councilman? So there is a relevant difference between the language guaranteeing free speech in the Oregon Constitution and the U.S. Constitution?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Winston, yes, there is. The primary cases in Oregon, other than child pornography, there's basically no regulation. And I mean by child pornography, pornography involving kids.
Well, those are that's interpretation. I'm talking about the language, the specific language of the in the Constitution. I mean, there's a difference in the language, so that the United States Supreme Court has come to a different conclusion than the Oregon Supreme Court has come to, based on the difference in language. Is that correct?
Sir, that is correct.
Thank you.
All right. With that, I had no one else that was registered to give testimony today on SJR 28. I do want to ask if anyone else wanted to come forward. Not seeing. Okay, ma'am, come on up. Hi there. You'll be so kind to give us your name and then your testimony.
It is Felicia Montejano.
Could you say it one more time?
Felicia Montejano.
Thank you.
I wasn't really originally planning on coming up to speak, but just hearing the things that the opponents were saying about how they're trying to regulate what the people see who are going to businesses and all that, they're not planning on doing that. They are only, I live in Canyon Road area, by the way, so I'm in part of this neighborhood who has Pussycats, VIP Las Vegas Private Rendezvous, which is a lap dancing place for those who are 18 and older, and also by Hotties. And I just want to say I have an example of how this is actually affecting the neighborhoods. I have at least 4 friends who have been affected by Hotties because they have been offered at least $30 or more to just give these people lap dances. And they are 16. So they are getting affected by just living by these places. And the parents who live in these neighborhoods just want these places to be zoned to different areas, like industrial areas that are away from neighborhoods, so they don't have to deal with their kids getting exposed to places like these and getting jobs as these and for their futures, ruining their chances to getting professional jobs. And to me, that's a very serious issue because I don't like hearing my friends saying, oh, hey, guess what? I got offered $50 to go do this. I'm super stoked. That does not sound appealing, and it's sad to hear that. So I just wanted to say this because even though it has been rejected 4 times before for wording of different measures, I think if SJR, the people who are representing this, maybe reword it so places who are that are nudist or afraid of having their freedom of speech getting taken away, I think if they just reword it so it just purely shows that they just want it to be zoned to different areas and away from neighborhoods, I feel like this bill could actually pass. And I would just like to say maybe I should think about it so citizens of Oregon could get the chance to vote on it, because I feel like it is a serious issue.
Right. Thank you for coming forward. Scott?
For the record, Scott Winkles, representing the League of Oregon Cities. What the witness to my right so eloquently pointed out is a negative secondary impact that these businesses have on Oregon cities. The League of Oregon Cities does not desire to regulate the internal conduct of these clubs, of these establishments, nor does the League of Oregon Cities have any desire to regulate what was described by the previous panel in regards to nude recreation. Nor do we have a desire to regulate theaters. There are no secondary negative impacts or to the quality of urban life from those sorts of establishments. Again, what we simply desire is what is allowed under the Renton decision. U.S. Supreme Court, our neighbors to the north, city of Renton, Washington, went to the Supreme Court. There was a case was adjudicated, and what that would allow us to do is simply zone these businesses in a place where we can minimize those negative secondary impacts, such as crime, loss of other commercial interests, and quality of life. The Renton decision does not allow the barring of such establishments, nor does it allow the regulation of internal conduct. Again, all we are seeking to do is give us a tool that would not be easy to use, mind you, as these would be controversial decisions as to where that zone would take place, to improve the quality of our urban environment. With that, I'm eager for your questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you all very much for coming forward. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on SJR 28, and we're going to open up our next public hearing on SB 876. Council?
Chair, members of the committee, SB 876 addresses a collateral source rule situation where if a party is injured and they have insurance and they also recover against the tortfeasor, it's an issue of whether that money should go to the person that's injured or whether it should go to the person who's paid through the insurance program. It allows an injured party civil action covered by Medicare, Medicaid, or the state children's health insurance to collect medical expenses from the person causing the injury. Only extent the injured party is obligated to repay Medicare, Medicaid, or the state children's health insurance program excludes from the collateral source for benefits provisions, health, and disability payments only the amount of premiums paid during the 10-year period immediately preceding the injury or death. Mr. Chairman.
All right, thank you. First panel is John Powell and Paul Danner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies. With me is Paul Danner, employee of State Farm and legal counsel to State Farm Insurance Companies. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I've handed you two documents. One is just kind of a fact sheet. The other one on my firm's stationery, which basically outlines the issue that the court decided in White versus Jubitz. And that's, in that case, it presents the issue that we bring to you today. And what this document does is lets the court's own words basically describe the issue at hand. And in this particular case, as the summary in the Supreme Court on the first page of this handout points out, a fellow walks into a bar, sits on the bar stool, and it collapsed, and he is injured. He is taken for medical care and received billings of about $37,600 for that medical care. Subsequent to that, the fact that this person was 65 years of age qualified that person for Medicare benefits. Those benefits paid the providers a total of $13,400. And under that Medicare system, that those providers must accept that reimbursement as full payment for the services that they rendered. The court in this case, trial court, court of appeals, and Supreme Court, felt compelled to allow recovery of the entire $37,600 when in fact only $13,400 was paid out. So why would they do that? On page 2, the Court of Appeals, I think, summarized best the issue at hand, and that is Medicare is a creature of the Social Security Act. And the way our collateral source rule is written, that would mean that Social Security benefits cannot be deducted from a judgment, even though it might mean double recovery. And the court simply said that they're compelled then to follow that act and not allow for a reduction to meet the actual payment made. This case was not without a dissent. Two Supreme Court justices, Kistler and Ballmer, dissented, and I think what Justice Kistler wrote is instructive, and he said, and I quote, "As I read the governing Oregon statutes, medical charges must be incurred to be recovered as economic damages. In this case, neither plaintiff nor Medicare ever incurred liability for more than the Medicare gap. It follows that plaintiff may not collect damages for costs that no one incurred." So I respectfully dissent. So that's the issue, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Senate Bill 876 is an attempt to rectify that situation so that the actual damages that a person paid or was responsible for are subject to the Collateral Source Act, and that a recovery of this magnitude for costs not actually incurred or paid is not a part of the final award. And I might say, in addition to the award for the economic losses, this person received $100,000 in general damages as well that this bill would not affect. So, Mr. Chairman and members, we understand that dealing with the collateral source rule can be complicated and hard to understand, but we've tried to present this in a way that you at least can get a grasp of the issue that the White v. Jubitz case presented. And we would be glad to answer any questions. There are two statutes that this Senate Bill 876 amends is the collateral source rule, which is 31580, and the definition of economic damages in 31.710. Those are the two statutes the court addressed in White v. Jubitz.
All right, thank you. Paul?
Thank you, Senator. My name is Paul Danner with State Farm Companies as counsel. I'd like to start with what this bill is not intended to do. We're not here to criticize what the court decided in White versus Jubitz in that it felt compelled by existing statutes to come to the result that it did. We're here to try to change the statute that it relied upon in coming to that result. The collateral source rule does not prevent double recoveries. It's intended to suggest that a defendant should not benefit simply because a person has had some third party pay bills on his behalf. And it's designed to be, it's a rule that's been around for 100 of years. When the court looked at this and they agreed that the common law, the collateral source rule does not concern itself with double recoveries, it says, absent a statutory provision to the contrary, the policy of Oregon under common law is to allow such recoveries. Our objective is to change the collateral source rule in a way that eliminates what can be windfall recoveries to people, understanding that those recoveries must be paid for generally by the persons who purchase liability insurance and have to pay that expense, when in fact those monies are not going to compensate someone for actual out-of-pocket expenses. So it will not reduce the award of damages when a claimant has an obligation to repay someone. It will not reduce award of future damages. It will not reduce damages allowed for pain and suffering that are typically called general damages. It won't reduce awards by amounts that people have recovered for life insurance or other death benefits. What it will do is reduce an incentive to build up medical specials that might overstate or exaggerate or inflate damage recoveries, and it will allow juries to consider actual versus overstated damages when they are asked to deliberate and make awards. So with that, we would simply, on behalf of State Farm and the individuals that pay the premiums and have to pay for the liability insurance that often pays for these exaggerated damages, we would ask that you support SB 876.
All right, thank you. Questions, Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If after an injury the medical bills are paid in full and then the award is for greater than that actual cost, how would that differ from really just an additional non-economic award, an additional general award? It just seems like it's just adding to that non-economic award because the medical bills, in fact, have been paid.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Witzit, I believe what you said is accurate. It just becomes an additional award with no title. No one paid it. No one was required to pay it, and so it just becomes an extra award.
Thank you.
Other question, Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, you started a statement. A guy walked into a bar, but you never gave us the punchline. I thought you were setting us up for a joke or something. So I have a question about the provisions on page 1, lines 17 through 20. And I wonder if you could kind of explain how that would work on the ground, and especially how that would impact if you had, for example, a small business and they had employees and they were covering insurance. What is the business's responsibility? Are they supposed to track for 10 years what's paid and who pays it? And I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, please.
Senator Bonamici, the intent is to recognize that the third party that pays the bills of an individual when they have medical expense or disability benefits after they've been injured. This is not ongoing disability that they may have had at the time they were injured, but when they are injured and then those benefits are provided. To the extent that those benefits have been paid for by the injured party through premiums for insurance, the individual should be given some credit for having obtained that collateral source. So the intent here is to just simply suggest that we're not trying to have it be that just because you had the foresight to have insurance, that means the defendant is relieved of all responsibility. To the extent that there's 10 years worth of premiums that you could demonstrate that you used to purchase that kind of insurance, the award would not be reduced by the amount of those premiums.
So, Mr. Chair, can I ask a follow-up?
You may.
So is it the employee's responsibility to track the payments over 10 years or the business's? Whose responsibility is it to track that record of 10 years of payments?
Senator Przanski, Senator Bonamici, I would presume that would be a matter of simply presenting information about what kind of premiums you've paid over that kind of time period. It's designed to basically accord to what is already in today's collateral source rule that suggests that if you've paid premiums for insurance, that insurance cannot be reduced from an award. The benefits paid by that insurance cannot be, you can't be precluded from recovering those monies, even though it may be amount to virtually a windfall if there's no responsibility to reimburse that insurer. We're not trying to change the rights of subrogation. If a carrier is going to be reimbursed from the recovery you make, the court would not reduce a damage award by that amount. It's only in an instance where you're not required to reimburse anyone, the bills have been paid for, that there will be the court would be required to reduce the award in those instances, but not by more than what you've paid for premiums for, and we said 10 years. We picked that number simply as very, very reasonable to assume that that there's not going to be a suggestion that the defendant shouldn't benefit just because you had the foresight to buy insurance.
Can I ask another question?
You may.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does this bill affect workers' comp? And I just wonder what the implication is and whether there's some sort of state involvement with the workers' comp system.
Senator Prezanzi, Senator Boymich, if workers' comp has a right of reimbursement, it will not affect the award of damages, or the court would not reduce the award of damages if there's an obligation to reimburse the workers' comp carrier.
Any other questions, counsel?
Sir Paul, when you talk about pays the premiums, if I write the check to the insurance company, then I can recover twice, but if my employer writes the check, I cannot. Is that correct? I'm trying to figure it out. What do you mean by paid for?
I believe it would be the other way around. If your employer has purchased benefits for you, and it's a collateral source then that pays for damaged medical expenses for you, you're not directly out of pocket for the actual cost of the bills that related to the tort injury.
Okay.
If there's an award of those damages to you with no obligation to reimburse anyone, it's basically a windfall. And as Senator Whitsitt explained or asked the question, it is an exaggeration of the actual compensatory damages, because they're really not compensating you for anything out of pocket at that point. So if you're the one who has paid the premium, then you should be giving credit at least to the extent that you've made such premiums payments, and the award would not be reduced by more than those premium amounts. But let's see.
All right. Any other questions, comments? Thank you all very much. The next person I have signed up, I believe it's Tom DeMar. And if I mispronounce that, please let me know. And is there anyone else who will want to give testimony on Senate Bill 876 today? Tom, are you ready?
Senator Prozanski, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom D'Amore. I'm the president of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I represent seriously injured victims and their families of wrongdoers and against wrongdoers and wrongdoers insurance companies. I use the term wrongdoers. That means negligent parties that have committed a criminal act causing injury, and parties that have engaged in intentional act causing injuries. I've practiced for 20 years. I'm licensed to practice in Oregon, Washington, and California. I'm formerly a CPA, so I understand the personal and financial implications of the collateral source rule and SB 876, which attempts to take away, in effect, the collateral source rule. The public policy for the collateral source rule is pretty simple, although this statute has been made very complicated. And the question is, should the wrongdoer and the wrongdoer's insurance company get the benefit of the injured victim's investment, premium payments, and insurance coverage that they've paid perhaps over a lifetime? Said another way, should the injured person suffer the lost investment because of the paid premiums that they've made, and then again suffer a reduction in their recovery? This same committee, 24 years ago, looked at this issue, and the conclusion was that the injured person always should get the benefit of his or her planning and investment. It should not be taken away from them at the end of the case, and particularly in a case where someone has suffered serious injury. There are clear winners and losers with this ill-conceived legislation. Who are the winners? The winners are the wrongdoers, the careless, the reckless, the drunk drivers, those that have committed criminal acts. They are the winners under this proposed legislation. In addition, the liability and casualty insurers, the insurers for the wrongdoer, under this legislation, they wouldn't have to pay for recovery. The obligation would be transferred to the injured person who is losing part of their recovery, and also to health insurers and disability insurers. Health insurers and disability insurers would be footing the bill for what wrongdoers insurance companies should be footing the bill. Under the current law, the injured victim obtains the recovery from the wrongdoer and then reimburses health and disability, Medicare, and other insurers. There would be little incentive to recover the funds for these health insurers, disability insurers, given the cost of doing so and the reduced recovery under this ill-conceived proposal. Consumer rates, we've seen, have gone up dramatically over the last several years. This legislation, if passed, would further increase health insurance premiums because it shifts away the obligation from the wrongdoer's insurance company onto health insurers. The wrongdoer's insurance company or casualty insurers would see a huge boost to their bottom line. It should be noted that in every case, the plaintiff or the injured person has to put forth evidence, medical testimony, that the medical bills are reasonable and necessary in every case. The defendant can come in and put on their own testimony that the medical expenses are not reasonable or not necessary. 876, SB 876 would create an unworkable and unnecessary burden on small businesses. This arbitrary 10 years of looking back for premiums would be stuck upon the injured person or their employer. What business tracks 10 years of premium payments for every employee? How many employees stay at the same job for 10 years anymore? How many employers keep the same health insurance for 10 years? For most, this provision that's been proposed is no benefit at all to the injured person. In conclusion, the public policy reasons dictate that SB 876 should not be considered, and it has been considered 24 years ago by this committee and rejected. Elimination of the collateral source rule under this legislation encourages bad behavior. If wrongdoers are not required to pay for the full amount of damage caused to innocent victims, then there will not be, the public policy of holding wrongdoers accountable is lost. On page 4 of some written materials that I read from the opposition, these seriously injured people are accused of being unscrupulous claimants, folks that want to game the legal system, seekers of recovery of fictitious economic damages, and that illegitimately inflate economic damages. Yet the same professionals that came before you, because I've represented insurance professionals myself, would be the first one to assert their full rights. If one of these professional sons or daughters were seriously injured or, God forbid, killed by a drunk driver, these professionals would be the first to assert their rights to the full extent of the insurance they'd paid for, including the disability premiums and insurance premiums they paid throughout their lifetime. There's three consequences of this proposed legislation. The seriously injured have already suffered financial, physical, and psychological damage at the hands of the wrongdoer. They would lose their investment of insurance that they've paid over a lifetime. They can't get those paid premiums back. Recovery is reduced because the consumer has their final award reduced after a trial. Under this legislation, the wrongdoer's benefit, the wrongdoer's insurance company benefits, the injured party who suffered the greatest loss loses. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Thank you,
Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, so in the White v. Jubitz, the criminal wrongdoer who wasn't let off the hook was the bar who should have known that the stool could have collapsed?
That was the negligent wrongdoer in that case.
Excuse me?
That would be the negligent wrongdoer in that case.
All right, any other questions or comments? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about what, under current law, I'm looking at the bill on page 1, line 9. The court may deduct from the amount of damages currently. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And so this changes it to mandate rather than giving the judge discretion?
Senator Bonamici, yes, makes it mandatory.
All right. Thank you very much, Tom, for coming forward.
Thank you.
I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on SB 876. I'm going to go ahead and first make an announcement regarding our work sessions. If you're here on Senate Bill 385 or 387, those bills will be carried over till this Thursday, the 24th, Thursday the 24th. The reason for that is that we have not received either a revenue or a fiscal statement for one of each of those, so neither of those bills can be worked today. So again, SB 385 and SB 387 will be carried over till this Thursday's meeting on March 24th. Now we're going to go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 416. The purpose of opening up the work session is to allow the individuals, interested parties who have been working on 416 to give us an update. Ross and Doug, I know y'all are here. Is there someone else that you wanted to have come up?
I don't think it's necessary. If there's somebody here that the committee would be interested in, then certainly I would urge you to do that.
Okay. And my understanding at this point, y'all are going to kind of just give us an overview of where we're at, and knowing that we don't have everything ready to move forward.
Good morning, Chair Poznanski and honorable members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Ross Shepard. I'm an attorney appearing pro bono publico from Eugene, and I appear again with my colleague Doug Harkelrode, who represents the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. We are indeed here this morning to report on the progress and update you on ongoing meetings that have been occurring, and I'd like to list for you the entities that I've been represented: the Judicial Branch, the District Attorneys Association, the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, the Sheriff's Association, Community Corrections Directors, the Public Defender Services Commission, Legislative Fiscal and Legislative Counsel's Office. And this rather large, it's getting larger group has been chaired very nicely by your counsel, Bill Taylor. The general tenor of these meetings has been one of cooperation and in many cases enthusiasm. There has been no philosophical opposition that has been raised to this bill. There are practical difficulties that we, all of us, will acknowledge, but the general idea that is embodied in Senate Bill 416 appears to be a good one. And an important part of that dynamic, Senators, is that counties aren't threatened by this. This is an opt-in dynamic. So even if the Senate Bill 416 were to pass and a county could say, we don't want to do this or we can't do this, the county's situation is not any further jeopardized. And I will further note for you that the three large counties, Marion, Multnomah, and Lane, and I will add Klamath, not as a large county, but as a county that has the infrastructure in place currently to implement the ideas of Senate Bill 416. And in broad measure, what this bill tries to do is to limit the number of individuals that are being committed to the Department of Corrections. The first group of folks that we hope to keep in the community rather than sending to our prisons are in very large measure, and I'm going to hold up the sentencing guidelines grid because I think you, all of you folks, have seen it and understand it. It's this yellow bottom box here that provides for rather short prison sentences for a vast array of denominated crimes. The bill, as I initially drafted it, would have taken all of those people and say that under some circumstances they are eligible for probation. With Mr. Hawkerode's gentle guidance, we have pared down that list and taken some really offensive crimes that shouldn't be eligible off the list. And the bill, as initially drafted, also inadvertently swooped up some Measure 11 crimes, and this bill does not deal with Measure 11 crimes. A judge would have to make certain findings to not send a person to prison and place that person on probation. The probation would then consist of a referral to an entity of some sort that is able to provide all of the list of services that you'll find on page 2, starting at line 8. This list was developed by the Oregon Governor's Reentry Council after a, I will say, an elaborate and thorough process of determining all of the needs that individuals have when they are released from prison. The evidence shows that these services are the exact same services that are needed for probationers in an effort to keep them out of prison. The second population that we're trying to deal with are those folks that have been in an Oregon penitentiary, are released on post-prison supervision, but have been determined to be at a high risk to end up going back to the penitentiary. I believe it's fair to say that every year we send between 800 and 1,000 people back to prison after they have been released from prison for less than 3 years. And one hopes that the treatment services that are outlined in this bill will make a substantial dent in that number.
Ross, just let you know we have about 4 minutes before we need to adjourn.
Well, what I'd like to do then is allow Mr. Harkerud to explain to you how we pared down the list of crimes and how we have refined what a judge needs to find to put someone on probation. Thank you.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Doug Harkerud here for the record. I'll be quick. We've got about 50 crimes on the list. None of them are Measure 11. We've run them by everybody in the group. Should it be in? Should it be out? These are people who are presumptive prison who would be put on probation under conditions. Those conditions are four conditions. One, do they are the principles of the Constitution that in Article 1, Section 15 better served by putting them on probation? Are there substantial and compelling reasons to do so? The third one is that a person who is on felony probation, parole, or post-prison supervision at the time the new crime is committed, they would not be eligible because they were already on active probation. And if a person has previously been given a downward departure, in other words, they didn't go to prison once before because they got a break and they got a downward departure, you only get one of those in 5 years under this provision. So that's the criteria we worked out. We've got a few more things to go. We've got to figure out what the dollars and cents is, and I'll stop there. You're off. I'm out of time.
Thank you. Questions? Gentlemen, thank you all very much for the update. With that, we're going to go ahead and close the work session on Senate Bill 416. And Council, anything else for today?
Chair, not that I can think of.
All right. And are we on for 8:30 tomorrow? Did anyone know that we agreed to start early? You're going to check. All right. Katie, you can check now.
8:30 would be nice, Mr. Chair.
Well, that's what I am leaning toward, but I want to make certain I don't say something I should. All right, so we got 8:30 start tomorrow, Tuesday. Thank you very much. We're adjourned for the day.